Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. You know, there's nothing like a clear, dark night, thousands of stars visible in the heavens with the Milky Way streaming overhead. Unfortunately, a truly dark night sky is rare here in America and increasingly around the world. In fact, it's estimated that 99% of Americans no longer experience a dark night sky. And 8 out of 10 children born today will never even experience a night dark enough to see the Milky Way. Even here in rural Oklahoma, we have some dark spots. Light domes from our big cities blot out a portion of the night sky. Well, my guest today writes about that loss and about light pollution in his book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Paul Bogart teaches creative writing and nonfiction at James Madison University. And for The End of Night, he traveled to the world's brightest city, which is not Shanghai, New York City, or Paris, but of course Las Vegas, as well as some of our few truly dark spots in America like Bryce Canyon and Natural Bridges National Parks in Utah. He visited with light pollution opponents who are trying to change how we light the cities to waste less light, and visited places like Flagstaff, Arizona, a dark sky city where you can still see at night, but the city puts out less than half the candle power of other cities its size. It's a fascinating look at the aesthetics of a dark, clear night, as well as a look at light pollution in America. Paul Bogart is my guest. Paul Bogart, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Your book, The End of Night, sort of looks at all the issues surrounding our night skies and how we, for the most part, try to eliminate truly dark night skies through a variety of lighting schemes. What interests you in the dark skies? What was it something you were fascinated with as a kid? Is it something you've always wanted, you've always loved to experience, or what exactly?
I think it does start with that firsthand childhood experience. I grew up in Minnesota, and we have a cabin up in the northern part of the state. And at least when I was growing up, it was still very dark up there. It's still dark, but there's you can start to see a little bit of the light pollution on the horizon now, unfortunately. But that childhood experience stayed with me. And later, actually after college, I really started to learn the constellations, learn the night sky, and very quickly, when you start to learn the night sky, you start to learn about light pollution and how all the light in the sky really limits what we're able to see. And when you start to learn about that, you start to learn about all the other impacts that light has on our world at night and on the darkness that is so important to us as a species and as a planet.
And that was perhaps one of the most interesting discoveries in this book, is how important darkness is to how we operate as humans. We're evolutionarily designed to have a dark night. And when you have any major metropolitan area, when you have a cloudy night, it's like a gloaming all night. You know, it never gets dark.
Mm-hmm. No, it really is. In fact, there was just a study done in Germany within the last couple of years that found that on those cloudy nights in cities, the light there is actually amplified about 10 times as bright as it normally would, and it's oftentimes bright enough as it is. But one of the facts that I come back to all the time, no matter kind of what I'm talking about in terms of the end of night, is this: that life on Earth evolved over billions of years to the natural rhythm of bright days and dark nights, and we need both. We need that sunlight for health, but we also need that darkness. And it's really been in the last, 20, 30, 50 years that we've seen this explosion of electric lights in our lives. And, you know, evolutionarily, that is just no time at all. Our bodies haven't had any time to adjust to that, what is a really sudden experience of electric light. And it's having some serious effects on us and on the world around us as well.
Now, as a part of your book, you would expect to be talking to people who advocate dark skies, but you also talk with health researchers who are everything from sleep researchers to people who are looking at the effect of light and, for example, shift workers that sort of work revolving shifts where some nights they're working nights, other days they're working days, and that revolving of messing up the light cycle for their circadian rhythms. What did you find when you began talking with these sleep researchers and the like?
Well, you know, it's a great point, and I think that something I come back to again and again is that this issue really isn't, it's not just about astronomy. It's not just about, as important as it may be that we're losing starry nights, I think more people will probably be interested in the fact that it's affecting our health, our human, physical, mental, and spiritual health, I think. And in terms of the physical health, what I've found, what folks told me is that light at night is affecting us primarily in three different ways. The first is that it's disrupting our sleep. And sleep disorders now are tied to every major disease that we're dealing with. And sleep disorders are just a huge epidemic in this country. Secondly, as you mentioned, it's confusing our circadian rhythms, those 24-hour natural rhythms that are tied to this natural rhythm we were talking about earlier of light and dark. And when we confuse that, it messes with the internal workings of our body, essentially. And then finally, what they've found is that light at night, exposure to light at night, impedes the production of the hormone melatonin, which is only produced in our body in darkness. And a lack of melatonin in our bloodstream has been linked to an increased rate of breast cancer and prostate cancer. So much so that the World Health Organization now lists working the night shift as a probable carcinogen. So folks who are working a night shift, especially those folks who, as you mentioned, you know, work at night sometimes, work during the day sometimes, they never get back into that regular rhythm, are most susceptible to this stopping or impeding of the production of melatonin and most at risk for these cancers.
Now, the cancer link is not absolutely proven at this point, although there are researchers looking at this.
Sure.
Are employers looking at this at all?
You know, that's a great question, and you're right about the cancer link. You know, nobody, the folks that I was talked to, that I talked to for the book, were very careful, and understandably so, to say, you know, I can't tell you that light at night gives you cancer, but this seems to be the direction we're headed, and I think the point that was made to me again and again was, why take the risk? You know, why, if you can, for folks at home, you know, sleep in the darkness if you can, you know, turn off those night lights and limit your risk. There's no reason not to. So, and in terms of the question for employers, you know, I think this knowledge about the health effects or the health risks about light at night is so relatively new. I would be surprised that, you know, if too many employers knew about it. And we really, in a 24/7 society, which we're increasingly becoming, it really presents kind of a conundrum. You know, I had one nurse in an ER say to me, you know, it's not like we can just close the hospital at 10:30 and say, you know, say, sorry, you're having a heart attack, but the hospital's closed. We have, you know, we demand that these places be open. But we can do a lot of things in terms of the type of lighting we use that would decrease the risk. And I think making folks aware that these risks do exist could then help us begin to address this problem.
Well, you begin your book by addressing the fact that now, under the astronomer John Bortle's scale of darkness, of 1 to, I think it's 9 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
we don't have any 1s left in America.
There's
a precious few, and it depends on the atmospheric conditions at that particular time.
Yeah, exactly. So the scale, the Bortle scale, starts at 9, which are our brightest places, which I visited Las Vegas and Times Square in New York City. But really, any major American city is going to probably be at about a 9, certainly an 8. And then working our way down to the darkest places, down to 2 and 1. And exactly as you say, you know, people told me that there may be some 1 places left, depending on the situation at night. But really what a 1 would represent would be absolutely no evidence of artificial light in the sky or on the horizon or anything like that. And so you can have an experience like I had in Death Valley National Park, which was one of the most truly dark places I'd ever been, so dark that it was kind of counterintuitively light with the natural light of the sky. But it still wouldn't rank a 1 because we could see on the edge of the horizon the light dome from Las Vegas or the light dome from Los Angeles. So even though it was so dark that you could see the stars revolving into the horizon, you know, this magical kind of darkness, it still wouldn't rank a 1, that sort of primitive, primal darkness.
And that's the thing that certainly in our part of the country here in the West, in the Midwest, we'll have dark skies, but you always have the light domes on the horizon. You never see the stars go off into the horizon because there will be some town or some city that's providing a light dome. And of course, when you get to those wonderful places, the few wonderful places out in the West, and you mentioned Death Valley, but Bryce Canyon is pretty dark. I think you went to Natural Bridges, which I've heard is one of the darkest places in the country. You do have that, at least in some directions.
No, you do. It's true. And I think, you know, the point to be made here is I do talk to a lot of folks who, you know, depending on where they live, say, well, it's really dark out here. You know, you should come out here. And, you know, I'm not saying that there isn't darkness left and that there aren't dark places, but the important thing is just the direction we're headed, which is toward ever more light. And one of the statistics that I think is pretty remarkable is that in the U.S. we have about a 1% or 1.5% population growth rate, but the growth rate of light pollution averages about 6%. In some places it's even higher, so we're just getting, every year we're getting brighter and brighter and brighter, and you know, those, I've talked to folks who work out in the national parks out west where we still have these beautiful skies, and they say, you know, it's not like it was even 10 years ago, and they're worried about what it's going to be like 10 or 20 years from now if we don't start reining in our lights.
And one of the things you discovered is that we as humans are attracted to light, and marketers know it, business owners know it, employees that work at night know it. And you relate some really interesting anecdotes about if you try to turn down lights at night, immediately people say, turn the lights back up. We need it brighter. And if you turn it back to where they were, they say, no, that's not bright enough. It needs to be brighter. And marketers, for example, the reason shopping malls and gas stations and various places have such bright lights, security is part of it, but it's really not the main reason. It attracts people.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, whenever I or anyone else starts to talk about, you know, the challenges and costs of light pollution, the first response we might get is, well, we need all this light for safety and security. And I think that the problem is, you know, while some lights at night can definitely help us become more safe and secure, that doesn't automatically mean that ever-increasing amounts of light will make us ever more safer. And we can really do, actually improve our safety by lowering our lighting levels and shielding our lights and still having lights, but using light responsibly. And as you said, you know, a lot of folks think that gas stations, parking lots, shopping centers are so bright because of the safety issue. But it really has more to do with both attracting us, like gas stations are the perfect example of come buy our stuff. You know, that's what those lights are saying. And if the one gas station on the corner becomes brighter, then the other gas station on the other corner is going to say, wow, we better get bright as well. And you get kind of this back and forth that, again, really has nothing to do or very little to do with the safety and security issue. So I think what we're asking, you know, what we're hoping is that as people become aware that of how much light we're using, that we can use a little bit less, we can use it more responsibly, still have light, still have safety and security, but not be blasting light, you know, straight into the stars and straight into your eyes and that kind of thing.
My guest today is Paul Bogard. He teaches creative writing at James Madison University and is the author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light, where he goes for nighttime walks in London and Paris, visits our national parks, talks to health officials about the use of light. He talks with lighting experts about good lighting versus bad lighting. And one of the things you talk about is, you know, we think that just having lighting provides security, and certainly safety and security issues are important. But in your book, you actually show how poorly designed lighting is actually worse for your night vision than having good security lighting, and the fact that because we have so much lighting and it's not uniform, it actually makes us a little more dangerous when we're out on the streets, because lighting ebbs and flows. It's bright some places and dark others. Our eyes just can't adjust that quickly to the dark spots from the light spots, which causes glare issues and makes it difficult.
Yeah, exactly right. You said it well. I mean, I think that's one of the things that in my research really surprised me, was this issue of how light actually affects our safety and security at night. Because I think, you know, anyone who's younger than 40, certainly, and even 50, has grown up just surrounded by electric light. And we think that it's just normal, and it's the level of lighting is growing every year, just slowly enough that we don't really notice. And again, the excuse is always that, well, we need it for safety and security. But one of the best things I found, and this is in the book, and are two back-to-back photographs that were taken by an astronomer in Florida who wanted to show the effect that an unshielded bright light can have on our vision. And so this is what we call a security light on the side of a house that is unshielded. That is, it's allowed to kind of blast its light in all directions. And the first view is you're looking at that light and this yard, and you're thinking, okay, there's that bright light, right? What am I supposed to see? And then in the next view, the next photograph, the photographer has just held up his hand to block that light. And all he's doing is basically what we say, shielding that light, making the light, not turning the light off, but just sending it down to the ground. And then when he does that, suddenly you realize you can see beyond that light, and you see the bad guy, as it were, standing in the fence there. You know, it's just his friend. He's not really threatening him. But the point is that in the first shot, when you had this really bright light, you couldn't see beyond it. In the second shot, when you shield that light, you can see better and see beyond it. So the point being that we think because we have all this bright light that we're safer, but it's actually making it harder for us to see, and that's not, you know, conducive to safety and security. So that's just one example.
Now, some communities have experimented with turning their streetlights out at night. In fact, here in Tulsa, when the big crash hit in 2008 and 2009, we did it for economic reasons, and of course, immediately people everywhere clamored, we want our lights back on. We can't see at night. And right. that's been sort of the mixed response. Has there been any communities that did that and continue to?
Oh, sure. And I think, you know, there are a lot of communities, both in the States and in Europe, that have turned down their lights or turned off their lights after a certain hour of the night. And what they've found generally is that there has been no increase in crime. But they've also found exactly what you found in Tulsa, which is that folks are so used to having light that they just want the light back no matter what. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's happening that's really exciting is the country of France. So an entire country has just started new lighting rules where they're doing some of these things like asking or demanding that businesses turn their lights off after 1 o'clock in the morning, or that public buildings be, the lights be turned off in the public buildings an hour after the last employee leaves. Just sort of common sense moves that we can make to control some of this light. And I think communities can do a similar thing, you know, turn off some of the lights or turn off the lights after a certain hour or, you know, that kind of thing. It's just this sort of common sense approach that I'm always trying to urge people to see that, you know, nobody's saying no lights, we can't have light. We're just saying let's think about how we're using light.
And it's fascinating, you know, we think of lighting as providing security, but you actually talked to a couple of criminologists who said criminals like light. They like because they can see who their victim is. They can see who's a possible victim if they're thinking about mugging somebody at night.
Exactly.
If they're out at, like at a warehouse or something, if it's well lit, they can see anybody who's coming maybe to bother them as they're doing their business. They're just as human as the rest of us. They like a well-lit atmosphere to do their work as well. I thought that was really funny, actually.
Yeah, me too. It was one guy told me in London, he said, you know, criminals are afraid of the dark as we are, and they like to be in the light. And, it makes sense if you think about it. You know, criminals need light to operate in as well, and they're going to be one of the, you know, lights that we see all over the states are these quote-unquote security lights or yard lights. People have them, and you can see them from miles away kind of thing. And folks told me that, you know, in many ways these lights actually act as beacons as much as they act as to ward off criminals. You know, people are, they can see the properties, they can see the yard, they can see if anybody's home. They actually really don't do a whole lot in terms of making us safer and more secure.
Well, one of the things you did do is go to places like Flagstaff, which is a dark light city. And having been there at night, I can tell you it is a darker environment, but your eyes adjust. And because the lights are just sort of uniformly at a low level, your eyes adjust and you're able to see it's just not quite as bright as you're used to seeing a cityscape. But you can still see everything.
No, absolutely. I mean, I have kind of a little fun with this when I'm in Flagstaff with a friend and we're driving around and he's pointing different things out to me. He's an astronomer in Flagstaff, and we're coming up to a gas station where, as you say, the lighting is at a lower level. And I said, you know, pull in here and let me see if I can actually pump gas under this lower level of light, you know. And of course you can, because as you said, your eyes have adjusted to it. It's totally fine and that kind of thing. And I think, again, you know, we're so used to lights being so bright and all over the place and really glaring all over the place that we think, well, this is just how it is. This is reality. But in fact, cities like Flagstaff, Tucson in Arizona, major cities in Europe like Berlin, Copenhagen, Amsterdam, have lower levels of light, and everybody's getting along fine. And so it is basically a choice. Do we want to waste energy, waste money, waste light like we're doing, or do we want to use it more responsibly, more thoughtfully?
And the book also describes the difference between bad street lighting and good. And really, that's the other thing is we're lighting things brightly, but we're wasting a lot of the light because it's going up into the sky and not really down to the where you would want the light, on the ground.
Yeah, exactly. The if folks are interested in finding out about any of these issues, finding out more, the International Dark Sky Association at darksky.org is a great source. And one of the numbers that they use is that every year the U.S. wastes more than $2 billion alone just on the light that's just sent up into space. That does no good, nobody any good. It's not lighting anything. It's just being sent up into space. And I think, you know, what I'm trying to do with the book is to just make folks aware of that. And I think, because I think most reasonable folks, when they start to think about that, are going to say, that doesn't make any sense. Like, we should have light, but let's have light directed to the sidewalk, directed to the street, directed to, you know, our house or whatever. We don't need to be lighting up the sky.
My guest today is Paul Bogard. He is the author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. Kind of skipped over this, but there was a really interesting section where I mentioned that you walked at night in London and Paris. In fact, in London, you follow the people who they still have gas lights there, and they actually have people who take care of the gas lights in London, and you sort of follow them around. Then you met in Paris actually has a lighting designer, which doesn't surprise me about Paris, but you met Francois Jousse, and everything is... It's choreographed. The lighting in Paris is choreographed.
It is. It's such a fascinating place to be. Folks might know the nickname for Paris, the City of Light. And it is. The lights there are really beautiful. But there's a reason for that, which is that the city has invested in their lighting. They spend more than 100,000 euros a night on their lighting. So a good amount of money. It attracts tourists and that kind of thing. The thing that really stands out to me is that over the last 30 years, this guy that you mentioned, Francois Jousse, has essentially relit the city. And so he's taken kind of the way that we light most places in the States, which is to just basically set up floodlights and blast light at the sides of buildings, you know, like just shine a bright light at. And he's really thought about how to light structures and even entire areas of the city in a way that, again, make the nocturnal environment more inviting so people can walk around at night in, again, kind of a lower level of light and have a feeling of really, this is really beautiful. The lighting really is beautiful. It highlights the beautiful buildings and that kind of thing. And so there are, you know, no place is perfect, and folks will tell you that Paris is, on the whole, still a bright, modern city. But, you know, for most of us who go, we're going into the old Paris, the touristy Paris, and it's lit very carefully to create this beautiful atmosphere, and we could really learn a lot from what they've thought about this.
The building, the lightings on buildings are all focused on the low floors, and in fact, the buildings sort of disappear into the night.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the, again, sort of sensible things that they've done, which is to light, you know, set up their lights about 15 meters up, so, you know, 20 feet into the air, just so the street is lit, but beyond that, they don't have any lights higher, so this beautiful effect where the if the buildings are, you know, higher than two stories or so, they kind of fade into the darkness. And just, I would, you know, a good example of that idea transposed onto the States, almost every city, town, suburb in the U.S. has car dealerships, and car dealerships are some of the brightest places in American communities. And if you go to a place like Flagstaff that we were just talking about, what they've done is to use the same idea where they have higher lights that light the lot during the business hours, and then they turn those taller lights off and just use lights that are about 10 or 12 feet high so they can still light the cars, you know, for their reasons, But we get away from all this bright light that's shining all over the place. So just a simple move like that, but same thing is happening in Paris.
I want to finish our conversation with the last part of the book where you actually try to find some of those very dark spots in America. You mentioned Death Valley, somewhere around Great Basin as well, in Nevada, which is on the Nevada-Utah border. Natural Bridges National Monument in southeastern Utah, and then Bryce Canyon National Park in southern Utah as well. Both incredibly dark places. What are we missing by not seeing the sky as you were seeing it in those locations?
Well, you know, you mentioned a lot of places that are part of the national park system, and one of the wonderful things that's happening is that the park system now has a night sky team that is working to preserve the darkness in these parks so people can have this firsthand experience like we talked about way back at the start of our conversation today that I had when I was a kid and that hopefully people have had, but that so many Americans are losing, which is this firsthand experience of coming face-to-face with the universe. It's hard to even quantify the value of that experience. You know, how important is it that we can walk out and see so many stars that you just think, wow, wow, that is just so inspiring and amazing, and all of a sudden my problems don't feel so big, you know, and it's just this wonderful, amazing, awesome experience that for all of human history has been a part of what it means to be a human being, and now in the last 20 or 30 years or 50 years, we've lost that, so I would encourage folks to get out into darkness around wherever they live, and if they can get out to some of these national parks, and go to some of the ranger talks, some of the astronomy programs, and start to learn about how important darkness is for us. Certainly read the book. I encourage people to do that as well. This is really an issue, light pollution, that we can do something about.
But without light pollution, I mean, first of all, you do see thousands of stars. I think 3,000 stars are visible. Yeah. Without light pollution. The other thing is, you know, sometimes even in Tulsa, you can see Betelgeuse in the Belt of Orion, and you can see that it's kind of orangey color. But yeah. When you really get in a dark sky, all of these stars have their own, you know, we sort of think of our star as a yellow star. But all the rest of the suns and stars, and they have their own particular color, blue, yellow, orange, red.
There's a beautiful passage in the book from a letter from the artist Vincent van Gogh, who's writing to his brother about the colors of the stars that he was seeing. And I think that, you know, for most modern Americans, we just think, what's he talking about? Stars are white. You know, we just
it's haven't they twinkle.
Had that. You know, we haven't really seen a true night sky. We haven't seen a night sky in all its brilliance. And you mentioned Betelgeuse and the constellation Orion, and you know, we can still see that in a lot of places, thankfully, but think about the fact that that star is brighter than 98 or 99% of the other stars in the sky, and oftentimes in many American cities, that's the only one of the handful of stars you can see. So we've lost 98 or 99% of the stars. That's kind of how far we've come just in the last few decades.
The name of the book is The End of Night. Paul Bogard, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Bogard teaches writing at James Madison University and is the author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. It's published by Little Brown. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.